Emma.
I'm Kiana.
I'm Tanasia.
I'm Lila.
And I'm Badila. And we're
the Perfect 10 After School. And we love to be a part of WGXC ACRA 90.7 FM, celebrating creative community radio for Greene and Columbia counties.
Turn out to Tubby's in Kingston on Saturday, November 5th for drone performances from Greg Davis, Hudson's M. Geddes Gengris, Troy's Ben Saraton, and Jay Ashdown. They all perform drones at Saturdrone at Tubby's in Kingston on Saturday, November 5th from 8 to 11 p.m. Go to the WGXC community calendar online at wgxc.org for more information.
WGXC underwriting support has been provided by Dedicated Presentation Solutions. Allow DPS to turn your audiovisual how-do-eyes into here's-how-you-cans. Visit dedicatedpresentation.com or call 845-475-8465 for more information. Dedicated Presentation Solutions, your audiovisual partner.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Tunstall Studio Publishing of Craryville, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You, too, can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and designating an amount of your choosing. Thank you for your support.
Welcome to Ginger Radio Hour. I'm Justin. You're listening to WGXC ACRA 90.7 FM. I'm live in the studio. And you're hearing Tonto, the monster synth. Famous for backing up Stevie Wonder. We're going to hear more of this in a moment when I get out of your way. But today on Ginger Radio Hour, it's a dreamy landscape for deep thoughts, thinking, pondering, and listening. In a couple minutes here, you're going to hear from the philosopher David Peña Guzman. He wrote this tremendous book called When Animals Dream. I'm going to feature a big part of our conversation that we had last week over Zoom. But to set us up for that, let's hear some more from the monster synth, Tonto, and much more music today here on Ginger Radio Hour.
These dreams. even know what to say. Even if you feel free, cause now my mind's made up. There's no looking back now. And now your mind's made up. So let's leave together. I've seen you laugh at nothing at all. I've seen you sadly weeping. The sweetest thing I ever saw was you asleep and dreaming. Well, you may not be beautiful, but it's not for me to judge. I don't know if you're beautiful, because I love you too much. I've seen you laugh at nothing at all. I've seen you sadly weeping. The sweetest thing I ever saw was you asleep and dreaming. I've seen you when your ship came in and when your train was leaving. The sweetest thing I ever saw was you asleep and dreaming.
Thank you. Bronco, baby. Broke the looking glass. 7 years of bad luck. The good things in your past. When you believe in things that you don't understand, then you suffer. So basta to shine the way. There is superstition. Wash your face and hair.
Was Macy Gray with Superstition from her album Talking Book, a cover of Stevie Wonder's Talking Book. And that brings us back to the very first song, excuse me, that I played today. That was from Tonto's Expanding Headband. Again, that's the monster synth computer that was created that backed up Stevie Wonder on Talking Book and made some of those incredible synth sounds that Stevie Wonder took advantage of. After that, we heard Alado Negro with Hometown Dream, The Magnetic Fields with Asleep and Dreaming. I'm going to prep this interview. We're going to talk about animals and dreaming in a moment. But first, some Mad Lib. Wow. Young Warrior off Mad Libs, Slim's Return. So I spoke with David Peña Guzman a couple weeks ago on Zoom. He's an associate professor of humanities at San Francisco State University. And he's written this incredible book, When Animals Dream, The Hidden World of Animal Consciousness. This is a book right up my alley. As an aspiring naturalist, but a layperson when it comes to really thinking deeply about this area of dreaming and consciousness, David approaches it as a philosopher and as a historian of science. And the book really got me thinking hard. And so it delighted me that he agreed to have a conversation with me. We spoke for quite a long time, and I wish I could play the whole thing today, but I'm going to make it available through the Ginger newsletter soon, so look for that. But first, here today on Ginger Radio Hour, a nice big chunk of our conversation. I opened it by asking him what shocked him in the research process. Here's David's answer.
Yeah, I think the thing that stands out the most when I think about what shocked me in the research process It's definitely the lack of language in the literature that I was moving through and wading through somewhat slowly, because it's a very vast literature. A lot has been published about the sleep patterns, the sleep architectures of multiple animals. And as I got deeper and deeper into that literature, I kept being haunted almost by this absence, which was the absence of the word dream or dreaming. So I was reading a lot of biology articles, neuroscience articles, physiology articles, evolution articles about how animals sleep, why they sleep. And yet nobody was talking about the possibility that while they sleep, they might also be creating imaginary worlds, which is what we call dreams. And so that sense of a specter hanging over this literature is what started guiding my thinking. And it was very surprising to me just the kind of aversion that I began to notice to the use of this term, which of course just carries a lot of baggage from a subjective phenomenological standpoint. It points to something lived, to something interior, to something that is not easily observable. And so I understand the aversion, I understand the reluctance. But as I kept reading empirical protocols about animal sleep, it became clear to me that there was a very robust case to be made for the dreaming abilities of a vast number of species. And I decided to write a book about it. That's how the book was born.
Well, as a philosopher, you have very specific rules about how you have to think through and write through your argument, right? But to the layperson, and I was thinking about this a lot. So I came to your book saying, of course, animals dream, not basing it on any, although I knew the octopus, the Heidi example that you cite in the beginning. But just from my own lived experience, or just my assumption is that, of course, they do. And I was taking my father-in-law to an appointment today, and I was describing to him a very specific scene in your book. And as I was describing this to him and some of the other things that you're writing about, this person who I would not consider having a liberal mind when it comes to many things, said, of course animals dream. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, why? And then, you know, he built an argument that was basically kind of linking animals with humans. And I just think that it's very different from 75 years ago, which you point out, and then very different again from 150 years ago, when I think people like my father-in-law, Bob, said, well, why wouldn't animals dream?
No, I think that's right. Cultural sentiments around animals have shifted. And what's fascinating about people's beliefs about animals is that they do cross the political spectrum in ways that don't often make sense to those of us who identify with any particular corner of that spectrum, because we assume most of our beliefs to have some element of polarization when you cross onto the other side. But there are conservative arguments to be made for the protection of animals. In fact, there's a very long history of conservative-leaning environmentalist movements where we see ourselves as stewards of the earth, who are shepherds of the more than human world, as well as theological arguments for the protection of other sentient creatures. And just as there are those, let's say, right of center arguments, there are centrist arguments and, of course, leftist arguments. And what I have found quite fascinating in working through this book, which is primarily in dialogue with philosophy and science, is that the enclave where I found the most resistance to the idea was in the scientific community. So yes, we can talk about there being a historical shift from 150 to 80 to, you know, 5-10 years ago to the present, but then there are these different islands of social life where different norms of discourse apply and that end up producing certain norms of evidence, certain ways of thinking about the world, certain ways of justifying belief that can strike those of us who are not members of that community or of that island as somewhat bizarre. And so nowadays there are, you know, a lot of lay people like the person that you're mentioning who would be completely open to the dreams of animals. And yet, as I discuss in the book, there are a lot of scientists, you know, all of them with PhDs, all of them with their own laboratories, highly educated individuals who actually go in the opposite direction and who put all their eggs on the basket of doubt when it comes to things that cannot be observed according to the same methods by which, say, a physicist observes the falling of a stone. But in some ways, one can understand the book that I wrote as a defense of the intuitions of the layperson. My argument is that, yes, that person is correct in asking, why wouldn't they dream? That should be the expectation that should guide our discussion. But you're right. As a philosopher, then, it's my burden to begin from the assumption that that's not taken for granted, and then to build a case on a solid foundation, and then try to talk about the implications of that belief once we have the empirical support for it.
So you bring up the scientific community. What has their reaction been to the book?
It's hard to tell. The book just came out a couple of months ago, so there's often a period of time for it to percolate, for the community to masticate it. I have gotten a mixed response. So I have received emails from scientists who have told me, oh, I really enjoy your book. Several of them have written about the book already in reviews or in various platforms. But I also get the sense that there are some scientists who see my approach to animals as anthropomorphic. And they simply believe that if you cannot prove something 100%, then you are at risk of projecting something that is uniquely human onto the non-human. And typically those scientists, I believe, see the expression of doubt or the expression of an agnostic position as a kind of scientific virtue. For them, it is the responsibility of the scientist not to go to places where there is, in their view, too much doubt. Where we disagree is on the question of how much doubt there really is about this particular phenomenon, and how best to explain everything that we know empirically about what's happening to the bodies and the brains of animals at particular phases of the sleep cycle. For me, the case for a dream phenomenology that is not human is significant enough that I can say it's a pretty safe bet.
I like that, a safe bet. That's good.
Yeah, and I think science is grounded ultimately epistemologically on safe bets, right? There are no absolute truths in science. And in the book, I do talk about what I consider to be a double standard that is often applied to animals in the scientific community, whereby we almost expect animals to meet a higher burden of proof before we extend certain cognitive, emotional, social, cultural capacities onto them than our fellow humans. And so for me, that is a reflection of what you earlier mentioned, which is that vanity that we have about our position in the cosmos.
You build this idea around what you call the zoological imagination. And I'm wondering if you can just try, I don't want you to recite your chapter, but just talk through a little bit of this phrase or this term that you build on.
Yeah, well, the imagination, much like language, much like morality, much like a sense of justice, is one of the concepts that has been most frequently used to patrol and to police the boundary between humans and other animals. So if you were to choose any one thing that we have that other animals don't, if you are religious leaning, you might say a soul. If you are more secular in your thinking, you might point to some capacity. Obviously, language is there, reason is there, morality is there, but imagination is one of them. And the idea is that imaginative capacities, so any act of imaginative creation, requires something that is simply too complicated for us to expect other animals to be able to do. When I imagine something, let's take a concrete example. Let's say that I imagine a red tiger. Obviously, the act of imagination there is unconnected from my physical surroundings. I'm thinking about a red tiger, but there is no red tiger in the room. And in fact, there may be no red tiger anywhere in the universe. It's a figment of my imagination. And so at its most basic level, the imagination requires the creation or the positing of an object in almost absolute freedom from the physical surroundings, from the environment. And that means that the animal that is engaging in an act of imagination, in this case, me, I have to transcend my environment. I have to bracket out what is here and now and go into another realm of existence or of imagination where certain things can exist that don't abide by the principles of logic, by the principles of physics. And so in this book, The Zoological Imagination, I argue that we need to resist this impulse to believe that imaginative abilities are the sole purview of Homo sapiens, because we have by now enough evidence from multiple regions of the animal sciences to think that other animals also have this capacity to make present to mind something that is absent from the environment. And so I talk about a number of cases that showcase this, like animals pretending, for example, or animals envisioning certain things that might not be related to what's in their physical surroundings. And so the argument that I make is that dreaming is an expression of imagination. There is something inexorably imaginative about the act of dreaming, because of course, when I dream, I create an entire world. It's not even an object. It's not just a red tiger. It might be a red tiger pursuing an equally imaginary prey against an equally imaginary backdrop. And so I create an entire world analog when I am completely severed from the realm of the senses. My eyes are closed. I'm not even noticing what's happening around me. And so I interpret this as a form of psychological, mental, or cognitive transcendence.
You mentioned some of the examples. Can you quickly tell the story of, I believe it's a chimpanzee and the blueberries?
Yeah, there is a case that stood out to me from the primatological literature of a chimpanzee named Pan Banisha that lived with humans in captivity, and she really enjoyed to pass her time by looking at magazines. It was a kind of enrichment for the animal, a way to pass the time, a way to avoid boredom and remain cognitively engaged. And Pan Banisha in particular really enjoyed magazines with photographs, especially photographs of food. And regularly she would do this thing with the human researchers that were also in the space, where she would look at a picture, let's say, in this case, it was blueberries, and she would play a game of pretense with humans where she would look at them. She would then look at the magazine that she was holding, which contained the photograph of the blueberries. She would make a hand motion as if she were about to pick one of the blueberries in the photograph. She would then look back at the humans, making eye contact, and then pretend in a joking manner as if she were eating the blueberries, as if they were real. And she would enact this very complicated, phantasmagoric performance of eating blueberries. And I interpret that as a very clear example of imagination and pretense being the primary motors of a particular behavior. It's not a behavior that you can even begin to understand if you don't attribute imagination and even deceit, the capacity for lying, to Pan Banisha. And I talk about a few other ones Most of them are from primatology, but that's only because that's what we have some of the most, that's where we have the most data when it comes to these sorts of imaginative behaviors.
I'm glad you brought up data, because early on in the book, you point out that it's really only in the last, I don't know, maybe two or three decades that scientists have started to look at animals' brains when it as a way of trying to determine if they dream. So it made me wonder if you can imagine a time in our lifetimes, you look much younger than me, so, or maybe in your lifetime, when these these questions are answered. And I only ask that because one of the hardest things, I know that we do know a lot about dreaming because of the study of the brain, but we also still don't know so much about the brain. And we Right. have been looking at that for a while. And so I just wonder if in how you think about maybe the timeline, the forward-looking timeline of when you may see more data that would help answer these questions.
That's a really good question, and it's very timely because I've shifted my view on this. When I wrote the book, I wrote it retroactively, looking at everything that had been created up until that moment. And since it was published only 3.5 months ago, suddenly there has been a wave of research on animal dreams that has taken me by surprise. So it's definitely not the case that my book caused it. I think that research had been going on already for months, if not a couple of years. And now it's coming out of that pipeline of publication in the sciences. But I actually think that in the next 4 or 5 years, we will see a cascade of research on animal mentation during sleep. Again, just in the last 3 months, there's been a couple of really interesting projects that have now been published about and covered in the media, including some research about spiders dreaming during their version of REM sleep, which is particularly fascinating because it brings arthropods into the discussion. And like insects, arthropods have been historically the example that is given for the kinds of animals that you obviously wouldn't attribute complex cognitive abilities to. They are seen as the counter argument that disproves a point. And now the possibility that they too have reality simulations in the middle of sleep changes our understanding of arthropods, but it also puts significant pressure on some of our mainstream commitments about the nature of mind. Because one of the things about arthropods is that they have, quote unquote, relatively simple brains. And so it means that cognitive horsepower may not be a matter of size. It might just be a matter of complexity and adaptability. And so little brains can do very big things.
Whoa, dreamy jumping spiders. Pretty wonderful to think about that. That was David Peña Guzman. He wrote this terrific book. You should all go to your local library or bookstore to find. It's called When Animals Dream, The Hidden World of Animal Consciousness. And for me, it's hard to imagine a better guest than David on Ginger Radio Hour. A place where I get caught up in new things and inspirations, and David helped me work through all sorts of those. Later in the interview, the conversation, he told me that when he was younger, he was a lucid dreamer and actually had quite a bit of power over starting and stopping dreams, even day to day or night to night. He also told me a story that really did blow my mind. He was stuck when he was writing this book on this very specific section on Freud and dreams. And it was days and days, and he couldn't work through this problem and how to continue the book past this certain paragraph and section. And the answer came to him literally in a dream. It appeared in a Word doc on a screen that he was looking at while David was dreaming. And when he woke up, he still saw it. He saw it in his head, and he sat down. And he kept writing, and his problem was solved. You can read more about David and that story in the Ginger newsletter. Just go to justinmaiman.com. That's where all of the Ginger newsletters are, as well as archival Ginger radio hours. We're also on Tumblr, of course. Again, thank you to David. Check out the book, and also check out his podcast. He's the co-host of a podcast called Overthink, where I imagine he talks and thinks and writes about, well, he doesn't write about on the podcast, but he, I imagine he talks through more about the philosophy of science and animal consciousness and much more. Check it out. It's called Overthink. Let's hear some more music. Thank you. This is Laraji. The tune, the track is called Celestial Dolphin. Couldn't imagine an artist that was better suited to close out this show. Before that, Grizzly Bear with Sleeping Ute and Pedro the Lion, the song Simple Economics. You've been listening to WGXC Acra 90.7 FM, and you've been listening to a Ginger Radio Hour full of dreams. Thanks to David. And thank you to all of you for listening. I have nothing else to say. Just listen.